Let me try to, I don't know how much time we have, but let me just try to do some case of extreme overlap with what Luis was saying, and just, again, just try to concentrate on a few of the points, the salient points. I don't want to get into the details. Luis gave you as much detail, I think, as you can get. And I just want to spend a few minutes concentrating on what I think is the important part that we have been talking about here. So I have just put five or six transparencies. Bear with me. Status report is, as Luis said, we have a fully nonlinear, stable, characteristic 3D code. There's a reference, you can look at it. As he said, we have made analytical studies of the stability properties of the algorithm. That's something important that you should keep in mind. And we have made validation tests of this code with arbitrary initial value boundary data, something similar as to what Dela was talking about. Not only that, we know that the code is there, it's stable, it's also second order accurate, and as Luis pointed out, it has been calibrated with a slew of solutions and situations where you can check whether you're getting the right answer in the linearized case, where you're getting the right answer in boost and rotation symmetries. You take Schwarzschild, and as he said, it's too boring because this is spherical coordinates, so there's nothing there, but then you can put rotating coordinates and see what happens. Luis also made very interesting runs with Robinson-Trautmann spacetimes, and you can also check that you are getting what you should be getting, and you can also do some amount of testing with nonlinear axisymmetric waveforms where you know that you have two modes of polarization. You would have two modes of polarization because of the symmetry. One of them is not there. The code doesn't know anything about the symmetry. So if you get zero, convergent to zero for that mode, you know that you are not exciting that one. And, all right. Again, to stress points, what does the code do? Well, given initial data and boundary values, you compute the spacetime, and you get waveform. That's the name of the game. Initial data is the free and constrained data that represents the gravitational degrees of freedom. The boundary data is the integration constant. And it was written here what the equations were, and on the other side, what are the constraints that the data has to satisfy. With all that, you can solve your nonlinear Einstein's equations, compute the exterior spacetime. Let me refer you back to Luis's previous talk about how you compute the news at SCRI and read from there the modes of polarization, the plus and cross mode. All right? Again, the inner boundary can be either a time-like boundary, with all the questions about whether this will pose or not. Good point. This is basically what we use when we do extraction or matching to a 3+1 evolution. However, the boundary, the inner boundary, can be null, and that's the double null problem, and in that case, it's much cleaner what we're saying. This is the double null initial value problem, and there's no ambiguity. So, just to say what I just said again, what is the nature of the inner boundary value problem? The worldview of data, the worldview of data that you're giving is, it's a strange way of saying it, but it's a hyperbolic version of a constraint problem. We are solving the other equations on the horizon, the constraints equation. I'll give you more detail if you want, but for the nonlinear boundary, the procedure that we're doing reduces, like Luis says, to integrations of ODEs. So let me borrow from a picture here. The data you're giving here on the initial surface is the unconstrained gravitational degrees of freedom, on the initial slice of this ingoing null surface, you have to give obviously consistent data with what you have here. On the ingoing null surface, on the inner boundary, you must give the free gravitational degrees of freedom, the same information that you got here, the HAD. On the initial slice of the ingoing surface, you must also give part of the extrinsic geometry. Then you look at the three remaining equations. Remember, there are 10, 6 that have been used for the evolution, 4 more, one of them is trivial. The 2 remaining ones basically reduce to ODEs that let you propagate up the null cone the remaining part of the data that he needs to give the boundary value. Okay? So, in a sense, when I say ODEs, well, I'm oversimplifying. Obviously, they are not ODEs, but you view them as integrations, as a march along the slices of the inner boundary. The same way that for the initial data, you specify just the unconstrained gravitational degrees of freedom, and you compute the rest of the metric quantities by looking at the hierarchies of Bondi's equations and doing radial integrations, given that you have initial values here. So that basically allows you to specify completely the data for the initial and boundary value. So, great. But what the heck is the free data here? The procedure doesn't tell me. That's the seed, the free data that I have to give. So what we take as the data for the intrinsic geometry, conformal geometry of the spheres here, is that provided by a conformal model. There are 2 references to 2 papers that refer to the axis symmetric and the non-axis symmetric case. Basically, what this model tells you is what is the free geometry, what is the intrinsic geometry of the horizon. Again, why are we doing this? Well,
I'm sorry, yes.
Sure.
They're saying mathematically whether you're allowed to specify free data or how do we choose?
Mathematically, you're allowed to specify free data, which is the intrinsic geometry. And also, you have to say what is the basically the aerial coordinate of this surface if you're working on Bondi's coordinate.
The issue you're asking is how do we
choose? How do you choose one? Some interesting problem, yes. And basically, the idea here is that we can refer to a standalone description of the horizon, which is explained in detail in these 2 papers. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I can if you want.
So this horizon is a fast horizon, it's a white hole horizon.
This horizon, good point, it's a white hole horizon. The reason for that, obviously, is the vein of the null cone formulation, caustics. If you have a past horizon, and let me just try to pretend that I'm drawing an embedding picture, instead of having your pair of pants, you end up with your upside down pair of pants. So we can cover the exterior region, the space-time region exterior to this horizon after the point of merge, but not before. If we try to do that, we'll have a caustic right away. But we can do this and look at the radiation at infinity. Sorry about the drawing, but okay? What you should see immediately is that the problem is really upside down. What I would be calculating as radiation in this case is what you would like to be called initial data, right? For the problem run backwards for the black hole merger. Well, you do what you can. As we said before, what basically it amounts to is a inverse scattering problem. You got the output, now you have to try to figure out what will make a sensible input for this problem. So, one couple points here. In this conformal model, particularly if you look at the embedding picture for the slices, if you look at the geometry of the slices of the horizon, when you look at the head-on case, at the axisymmetric case, you get your usual pair of point pictures. When you look at the non-axisymmetric case, something else happens. You find out that these slices have a toroidal stage. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture to put for you.
That's
a statement about slicing, but it's also a generic feature that you should expect to see in a non-axisymmetric case. Yes, it's true that any statement that I make about the horizon itself is a question of slicing. I guess if you don't slice where it bifurcates, whatever that means.
I mean, all the way down, you can always slice it such that spherical topology all the way down.
Well, but you have to avoid the seam here. You have to bend your slices.
Well, then you get two spheres. You don't get a the torus is just because you wiggled your surface.
It's true, and you could get anything you want if you wiggle your surfaces enough, but you should be ready to...
The question that we're getting at is that related, because you learn anything from this?
That's my question. will this lead to... No, because basically I think, and at this point you have to take the experimentalist attitude, well, okay, we have a code now that can couple these two things. Let's put that and see whether we get any interesting answer for the waveform. Maybe not. Maybe it's all swallowed up. You know that this hole in the horizon closes faster than the speed of light. So does anything go through? No, but I'm not going to give you an answer to that. Okay.
It's a data, right. And one of your initial data services you have initial, one of the null systems you have data that corresponds to a white hole horizon.
Yes.
And what do you choose as your other null surface?
The other null surface is an outgoing null cone emanating from one slice of the horizon, essentially.
And how do you choose what data you want to put on there?
Well, that is free.
I know, but
okay, so let me just try to draw a very, very flat picture. That's all I'm saying, okay? So, and you are asking, what data do you put in there? What is the interesting case? Well, I think what would be the interesting case is what you would have to put in order to get nothing over here, to get no radiation coming out of the sky. Because if you flip the picture over, then that will be the case where you have no incoming radiation. But can I tell you what it is? No. But if I look at this problem enough, if I kind of do some parameter search, if you want, then maybe I can zero in on that. And you still have a point if you tell me, well, but that's just one data. Because you put that, and you also put some information about what is going on in the horizon. But that's the nature of the beast. It's an initial boundary value problem. Describe that.
So it's one way of saying what you're doing, that you're guessing what happens on the black hole horizon and near Sky Plus.
Right.
And when you're evolving that guess backwards, to what physical system came from.
That's right.
Physical system, reasonable, then you say, okay, I have a solution.
Right. And if it doesn't look reasonable, then you start to have to play with your parameters and find out anything that, that looks reasonable. It's probably not the most desirable situation, but that's what we can do. And let me just try to get on. So what is in the works? Well, in the works, and probably I should say finished or under testing, Luis goes, what we have been doing lately is to combine the two things, the how do you give the horizon data and couple that to the characteristic evolution. Because the characteristic evolution code already has the computation of the waveforms, that's basically the tool that we need to produce, and I'll back after I'll say this, a catalog of post-merger waveforms, with the caveat that we are really solving the problem backwards. So that's very interesting, but how do we know that what we're doing has any relation with anything else? Well, one thing we can do is we can try to make a connection to perturbative theory. In particular, you can look at the head-on collision, that's the axisymmetric part of it, and you can take this model and you can see whether what you're getting reproduces or reduces or gets close to what you see in the perturbation approach. Now, sure, you can put this horizon this model for the horizon data there, and it has a bunch of parameters and you can tweak them, and in some cases it's just a very close to the close approximation, and in other cases it gets extremely nonlinear, and then you can see what departure there is, because we're not solving the linearized problem anyway. I thought you had in the transparency, and you're going to talk about that, the interpretation of the close approximation and where you see the caustics appearing, if you want to put that. There are some lot of issues there that we can look at, and there are some preliminary results, and I don't know if you got a chance to get that bloody movie if you have it. It will be very interesting because you can begin to see that there are differences in what you see in the perturbation approach. Other than that, let me jump slightly and mention something that Luis said also already, and so I'll just say it again, that another area that we're looking at is the incorporation of matter into a characteristic formulation. This is work that has already been done. Luis likes to call it the naive way. Well, I say it's not so naive necessarily. It's probably not state of the art. It simply means that you take your matter evolution equations and you call them straightforwardly. It does not use any of the state-of-the-art techniques such as shock capturing schemes. But for that, we are fortunate that we have collaborators such as Font, Papadopoulos, Ibanez, and company. And what we're trying to do is to integrate their matter formulation in characteristic coordinates and couple that to the code, PIP code. And then Luis already said that there are code parallelization issues, but I'm not going to talk about that particularly since I'm not doing any of the coding on that. And you can ask the one guy in the audience who is. So that's more or less what the status report salient issues are. And now if you have any questions, or if you want to put the... All right. Thanks.